I'm Dr. Peter McCullough, and I'm an internist and cardiologist and academic physician, professor of medicine at Texas A&M College of Medicine on the Baylor Dallas campus. And in February of 2020, like many physicians, I was really taken by storm with the news that a tremendously contagious virus was emanating out of Wuhan, China, and it looks like the United States was in the crosshairs. In the beginning, in my clinical practice, I really didn't have any viewpoint about prior viral pandemics. And some had mentioned prior influenza pandemics. If we go back to the 1300s, there was, you know, plagues that occurred across Europe. But point in fact, we were largely and very quickly thrown into emergency mode. And so what happened was a whole series of communications within health systems that really dealt with protection of the doctors and nurses. And Americans were introduced to a term called PPE, or personal protective equipment. And most of our task force meetings and calls really didn't have to do with sick patients. It had to do with protection of the healthcare workers and doctors. So I got a sense early on that fear, group fear, was a major driver in behavioral response to the pandemic. My research endeavors and my research life before COVID-19 centered on the interface between heart and kidney disease. I'm the president of the Cardiorenal Society of America. I'm considered the most published person on this topic in the world in history. I chair many FDA approved clinical trial data safety monitoring board. In fact, I've probably seen and examined more drug safety trial data than any doctor in current American medicine. So I'm well grounded in chronic disease epidemiology and randomized trials. But for COVID-19, our major viewpoint that we had early on, or at least for me with my prior cardiorenal collaborations, was with Italian doctors. And so we were starting to email each other in terms of what is going on in the Metro Milan area, in Milan and then down to Siena and Tuscany. And we quickly started to get an understanding that this illness was like a upper respiratory infection, like a common cold. And for a majority of individuals, it was like the common cold. However, in some individuals, it could progress to what we call the adult respiratory distress syndrome, where there's an overwhelming attack against the lungs. Patients lost their ability to breathe and exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide and then required mechanical intubation. So this was unlike any common cold, and it appeared to be very different than influenza. Influenza in elderly people can also cause the adult respiratory distress syndrome, but it's almost always because of a secondary bacterial infection like staphylococcal infection. So SARS-CoV-2, the virus, and COVID-19 appeared to have these special features. And then within a few weeks, we understood pretty clearly that the illness had three major biological features to it. One was early viral replication, where the virus replicates exponentially as other viral infections do, and that it has a second phase where the immune system is tipped off into a very abnormal maladaptive pattern. So instead of the immune system defending the body, the immune system sends out signals that begin to damage organs, including the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, the brain, the blood system. And then very importantly, the virus itself, through the spike protein or the dangerous spicule on the surface of the ball of the virus, the spike protein itself caused coagulation or blood clotting, and a unique type of coagulation. It's because it caused the red blood cells to stick together at the same time the platelets stick together. So this is a very different type of blood clotting that we would see with major blood clots in the arteries and veins. For instance, blood clots involved in stroke and heart attack, blood clots involved in major blood vessels in the legs. This was a different type of clotting. And in fact, the Italians courageously did some autopsies and found micro blood clots in the lungs. And so we understood in the end, the reason why the lungs fail is not because the virus is there, it's because micro blood clots are there. The waves of reports and published medical literature originally emanated out of China, the early ones, and the public should understand that the typical publication cycle for an academic paper that's peer-reviewed and published can be anywhere from 9 months to 2 years. So what happened was the publication cycles were too long to get any rapid information out. So immediately our system collapsed into what's called preprints. So publications would be submitted, papers would be submitted for publication, but the preprint would come out basically telling the world that the paper had not yet undergone peer review, but we need to get this information out now because people need to understand what's going on. So we had a wave from China originally, which was difficult to interpret because of English writing, because the Chinese population is just so different in terms of its structure. And it was hard to make much out of what was coming out of China outside of, in some cases, it could be fatal. Italy was much more like the United States. That was the next big wave, and we just collaborate more freely with the Italians. And what I had done is I had reached out to what's called the Coracle Network in Italy as an American doctor, and I, you know, freely said, listen, I am not a virologist or an immunologist, but I can tell you every infectious disease doctor in America is completely subscribed to inpatient care of patients with COVID-19. And there's nobody able to kind of think their way through what's going on in the pandemic. And so what we learned relatively early is that this illness was clearly and strongly amenable to risk stratification, or that baseline risks were very, very strong determinants, even more so than the virus itself, for mortality. So what that meant is the strongest determinant of mortality is age. And age itself is an underlying determinant or a cause of death, if you will, in the general population. Then we start adding on the typical things that put people at risk for death of other causes: heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, cancer, obesity, diabetes. The interesting thing is that obesity appeared to be a superloaded factor. And so the virus seemed to really prey upon patients, particularly who are obese. And there are some reasons for this in terms of how the cytokines and immune factors are generated in response to the virus that could explain it. But we understood quickly that individuals under age 50, for example, with no major medical problems, could ride through this illness very easily. And in fact, the Swedes figured this out very quickly and said, you know what, we're not going to shut down. We can just, this is sufficiently understood that we can simply protect the individuals at risk the best we can, the best that any protection measure can, and then we'll just have our economy and our schools move along in a usual fashion. With the pandemic, what happened is there was a global shutdown on travel and a global shutdown in academic meetings. So for the first time in my career, we could no longer meet with our colleagues in the United States or overseas. In academic medicine, its lifeblood is meeting and interchange of ideas. And so for the first time, we could not freely interchange ideas as a group. In fact, I recall a teleconference early on held by the National Institutes of Health, strictly actually by the Division of Insulin of Diabetes and Kidney Disease. It was that institute that I'm aligned with in terms of clinical trials. And it was led by Dr. Robert Starr, a terrific scientist. And as I recall, there were hundreds of people on that call to just learn about what was going on in other centers. And people were asking each other, well, what are you seeing out at UCLA? What are you seeing at Baylor? What are you seeing at Harvard? And so we were literally just communicating to try to understand what in the world is going on with this virus. Who needs to be hospitalized? What happens when they're hospitalized? Who needs mechanical ventilation? All of these interactions had us settle on the idea that this was enormously amenable to risk stratification. People under age 50 without any medical problems, unless they presented with severe symptoms, they were going to be fine. Honestly, it was going to be like a head cold. But over age 50, there became a real risk of hospitalization and death. And the two important endpoints were hospitalization and death. And you ask Americans, what are you afraid of? Are you afraid of getting a cold and being at home for a few days or a few weeks? No. So I'm definitely afraid of being hospitalized and obviously afraid of dying. Why was the hospitalization so frightening? Because for the first time, patients would be hospitalized. They were put into isolation. They could never see their loved ones again. Those who died actually never did see their loved ones again. The workers were terrified. They were wearing personal protective equipment. They had very reduced visitation to patients in rooms. They started using telemedicine services where the poor patients were in glass rooms. No one was coming in and seeing them. And the care that was offered was modest. Honestly, it was supportive care until patients needed to go on the respirator. So to sit in the hospital on oxygen, terrified, day by day by day, knowing being able to come in the room, not being able to see the family, these messages got out to other family members, and it put America on watch with extraordinary fear. Now, over the last year, I've published, and I've managed to get this out despite our incredibly difficult publication cycles, I've published 40 peer-reviewed papers on COVID-19. That may be more than anybody in America. One of my very first papers, the title of it, and the paper dealt with what are the important outcomes. That's hospitalization and death. And when I started to see that scoreboard come up on the major media channels where it listed positive cases and death, and all Americans remember this, this was up there almost instantaneously. It came from Johns Hopkins. Instantaneously, it was cases and deaths. And I kind of wondered, how did they get that information so quickly? That was amazing. We don't have death certifications and other things that are very rapid at all, and who could be determining this? But at any rate, it was up there. And what I said was, what we need to know is who's being hospitalized. Because if we can't figure out who's being hospitalized and we can't figure out where the hospitalizations are occurring, we don't know where to allocate resources. So I published a paper on this in the journal that I edit, Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. I immediately wanted to reach the American public. I published an op-ed in The Hill, which is a newsletter out of Washington. And I said, listen, there's an emergent need. We need the hospitalizations. And I screamed as loud as I could to the administration to say, listen, get an executive order to get the U.S. hospital census every day so we could see what was going on. It never happened. We got an executive order to get the positive test results to come in from all the major laboratories and through the hospital laboratories because all the tests for the virus were under the emergency use authorization. So it was linked to an executive order. So the positive tests were just coming in to the Johns Hopkins Center. So we knew who was test positive. There was no control over duplicates, by the way. So if a patient had one or two or three tests, unless the system had a way of actually filtering out these duplicates, those piled on. And it really didn't take into consideration who was sick and who wasn't sick. So we just had test positive. And then we had the deaths, which started to take on a cadence of trailing by about 4 weeks after the positive test cases. But that whole death ascertainment was a real mystery to Americans. And what I said, I think was around March or April, I basically made the statement relatively publicly. I said, listen, there are two bad outcomes, hospitalization and death. I'm going to put together a team of doctors and figure out how to stop these hospitalizations and death. I felt compelled as an academic leader in medicine, if no one in the White House could say that, no one in the White House task force could say that, if no one in the FDA could say that, or the NIH or the CDC, and Americans were pouring into hospitals and dying, no one could make that courageous statement uniquely and individually and alone, I made that statement. We had, our country's leadership, an inability to frame the problem. The problem was there was a virus. It was popping up in clusters in the United States. And in most people, it was causing a cold and they got through it just fine. And other people, it was leading to hospitalization and death. But we couldn't frame the problem that the virus in some people causes hospitalization and death. Let's stop it. Let's stop the hospitalizations and death. Let's treat the virus. We could not frame that problem. Our leaders couldn't frame the problem. I personally didn't have any problem framing the problem. It's a bad thing. If there was another form of pneumonia, out there. I would have said the same thing. Another form of newly acquired asthma, another form of a urogenital infection or gastrointestinal infection. Ebola had just been actually in Dallas a few years earlier, and I think Ebola hurt us in terms of our thinking because Ebola was so terribly contagious and so quickly fatal that the fear that Ebola created in Dallas was extraordinary. I'll never forget at our medical center, one time I tried to get in one of the usual doors that I go into, and there was a police officer there. I said, "What's going on?" He goes, "We're here to block anybody with Ebola from coming in our hospital. We're going to shunt them to Presbyterian Hospital north of us." When do we shunt patients away from one hospital? The fear that Ebola created because of this idea was terribly contagious and fatal quickly, I think, set us on edge. And with SARS-CoV-2 virus, what we learned is the average person sits at home for 2 weeks. There's no immediate lethality to the virus. In fact, we've got a long window of time to make a diagnosis, organize treatment, and prevent hospitalization and death. So SARS-CoV-2 was very different from Ebola. But we look at other conditions where we readily accept the fact that somebody can fall ill at home. But if we start treatment early with an infection, we can save the patient. That exists for community-acquired pneumonias. It occurs for various forms of staph infection, including staphylococcal toxic shock syndrome. It occurs for diverticulitis and abdominal conditions. It occurs for skin infections, various forms of cellulitis. It occurs for meningitis. And for instance, if someone had a form of meningitis, we wouldn't say, "Listen, sit at home for 2 weeks. And then if you're really, really bad and you're having seizures and you can't even breathe anymore, then come in the hospital and we'll start treatment." So the different unique aspect of the medical response to SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 was for the first time we had an infectious disease where the medical community settled into a groupthink. And this was supported by the NIH, the CDC, the FDA, the American Medical Association, all the medical societies. It was supported by these societies to tell doctors, "Don't touch this virus. Let patients stay at home. Let them get as sick as humanly possible. And then when they can't breathe anymore, then go to the hospital." In fact, it was shocking October 8th when the National Institutes of Health came out with their first set of treatment guidelines. Because prior to that, none of the societies had any treatment guidelines. They actually didn't tell doctors how to treat the illness. Now, there were suggestions about what should be done in the hospital, but Americans cared about what was going on when they got sick at home. And the first set of guidelines said, "You get sick at home, don't do anything. Don't do anything. Come into the hospital when you really can't breathe, still don't do anything until a patient needs oxygen. Then start doing something." Like, then actually give the first antiviral drug, which was remdesivir. Well, that's 14 days after the virus had already started replicating. By that time, the virus is long gone. When people can't breathe, the problem is microblood clotting in the lungs. So the federal agencies, the CDC, the NIH, and FDA, were enormously inept in terms of perceiving what this problem was, incredibly inept in applying any type of judgment or direction to doctors. And what had happened among the doctors was, "We're so terribly frightened, we're not going to do anything unless we have the intellectual support from our associations, from our federal agencies, from our medical societies." And it was just the opposite of what medicine had always been. Medicine had always been early innovation by doctors, empiric treatment, small studies, randomized trials, and then sponsored large randomized trials in that order. And then after large randomized trials, then guidelines bodies would then look at all those large randomized trials, make determinations of what should be done, and then those guidelines bodies would issue guidelines, and then the federal agencies would follow the guidelines. That's exactly what we do for mammography, colonoscopy, treatment of myocardial infarction, treatment of pneumonia. It always started out with early empiricism, then getting to guidelines and agency statements years later. It was a dangerous assumption. To assume there's nothing that one can do for a fatal infection is an enormous blunder. It's a blunder by citizens. It's a blunder by health responders, and it's a massive blunder by agencies. Can you imagine? Let's make an assumption. And could our assumption lead to the absolute worst possible outcome, which would be hospitalization and death? Or we can make another assumption and say, you know what, it's treatable. We're going to try to treat it. Which assumption is more dangerous? Absolutely. The dangerous assumption is to do nothing. You could take any example. Let's make an assumption on traffic safety. You can assume that traffic safety rules and lines and stop signs and seatbelts do something. Or you can assume they don't. Let's try. And let's have a free-for-all out on the streets right now and see what happens versus paying attention to some rules. We never make assumptions that are dangerous to people. And the thing that really worried me about this whole thing is this series of extraordinarily dangerous assumptions. Can you imagine a senior citizen who has heart and lung disease, who recovered from cancer, has some kidney disease, is handed a diagnostic test result and says, here, you have COVID-19. Now you have your fatal diagnosis. Our recommendations, based on the assumption we can't do anything, is go home and wait it out. And when that panic and that fear and that breathlessness and that fever is so overwhelming, when you can't bear it anymore, then go to the hospital. And how do people go to the hospital? They call family members. They contaminate all their family members. They call EMS, Uber drivers, taxi drivers. Every hospitalization in America was a super spreader event. So this assumption that there's nothing we could do in giving somebody a fatal diagnosis with no instructions led to a massive amplification of cases. So what we could have assumed, and what I did assume, was that there are some principles we can adopt from other precedents. For example, every form of pneumonia known to man does better if treated early, even influenza. And that's the reason why Tamiflu, as an example, and there's an analogous product, are FDA approved for the treatment of influenza. They have some partial effect. Now, do we ever use Tamiflu alone? No, we typically combine it with other drugs to get patients through the illness. There are supportive respiratory drugs. There are forms of inhalers, what's called beta agonist inhalers and steroid inhalers. We use those liberally in forms of emphysema, pneumonia, asthma, allergic pneumonitis. There's other things that we can do to help patients get through the syndrome. The inflammatory nature of the syndrome became very interesting. We understand that antihistamines, as an example, montelukast, aspirin, steroids, corticosteroids, play an important role. If I had an asthmatic at home, I wouldn't say, listen, sit at home for 2 weeks until you can't breathe anymore and then go into the hospital. Are you kidding me? I'd put that asthmatic on inhalers. I probably would use some empiric antibiotics in that patient and then some steroids, and I'd prevent the hospitalization to the best I could. So I approached COVID-19 respiratory illness like any other with the following thought, and we had pretty quickly put together our approach based on other precedents, including influenza, including asthma, including bacterial pneumonia, as follows: that this was going to be amenable to risk stratification. Those under age 50 who had no pulmonary symptoms, they could simply ride through the illness. We had data suggesting that nutritional deficiencies seemed to increase the risk for hospitalization and death. And so that's where the nutraceuticals came in early on, that there was supportive data, not curative, but supportive data for zinc, for vitamin D, vitamin C, and interestingly, a polyphenol substance called quercetin or quercetin. There were some others that were considered, including lysine and N-acetylcysteine. They became what we call the nutraceutical bundle. And so is it kind of reasonable to do that in patients? We'd say, yeah, if it's linked to mortality, we don't know anything else. There's no harm in these supplements. They're readily available. People can buy them. So we recommended the nutraceutical bundle for those under age 50 and really no medical treatment. That amounted to roughly, of people getting ill at the time, probably 2/3 to 3/4 of patients really needing no treatment. However, if someone below age 50 or medical